Thank you for being here. Remember to keep your camera on for us. I will be calling on you to ask questions of our guest speakers. Those of the others that have joined us, you're welcome to be here. I'm so glad to have you involved with our program, and we're pleased to be able to share it more widely than we have in the past on Zoom. So with that, I think we're going to go ahead. We have two really interesting speakers today. Our focus of the class is recreation, water law, and policy. And we have with us Greg Kernahan. I never know how to say your last name.
That's right.
Kernahan, who I met when I was director of CWCB, and Greg was working on Ducks Unlimited. And I still remember that award that you gave us and that duck that sat in my office, Greg.
Perfect. Good.
I'm going to let Greg and Ian introduce themselves. Our other speaker is Ian Stafford, who works with American Whitewater in a new position looking at policy issues for recreation. So I'll have him introduce himself. But each one of the speakers are going to spend about 20 minutes. Greg, I may interrupt you just to take some questions in between.
Well,
Nancy, can you put yourself on mute?
It doesn't say anyone is unmuted. Would that be
background? I think that's Greg at the airport.
That's background noise.
So you may get a little bit of background noise from me being at the airport. I found a quiet corner, but it's been quiet. I think we'll be okay. But
I thought Nancy was getting called out on a fire alarm.
Yeah, if you hear my name over the speaker, let me know. I may have me missing my plane.
Okay. Well, with that, let's go ahead and get started. And then, Greg, I'm going to turn it over to you. And thanks so much for being here.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for inviting me to participate today. As Jennifer said, I've actually worked for Ducks Unlimited in Colorado for the last 20 years, and a good part of the time that I've been working there, I have been more focused on water and water rights, which makes sense because I work with wetlands and waterfowl. Usually when I give these presentations, I ask people how many people know about Ducks Unlimited, and I can't ask you that, so I'll just give you a quick background. We are a wetland conservation organization. The map that you see on this slide is a pinpoint of every project that we have delivered in our 82-year history. We actually started in Canada and started delivering projects in Canada and then moved into the United States. It's only been about 30 years that we've been working in the United States. Our mission is to fill the skies with waterfowl, and we do that by satisfying waterfowl habitat needs, wildlife, and serving people. We've been very successful in our programs. We do that by having a focused conservation strategy, and that comes from working in these different priority landscapes for us. We're going to talk today about the Southern Great Plains region, which is where Colorado is located. One of the things that I like to highlight that basically just came out at the end of the year last year is there was a recent study completed looking 50 years back at the number of breeding birds in the U.S. And it turns out that we've lost 30% of our breeding birds, 3 billion birds, quite a few. But the bright spot in all of this was that its waterfowl actually have maintained their numbers or risen in their numbers. And a lot of that has to do with this focused conservation, having policies like no net loss of wetlands, WOTUS, mitigation opportunities, the kinds of things that Ducks Unlimited really focuses on accomplishing. And a good part of that comes because of hunter dollars, hunters buying licenses, hunters investing in the resources, which is a funny thing to talk about. And we're going to talk a little bit about today about the politics of water and transformational change. But like I said, I've been with DU for over 20 years. And if you go to our website, you will find that we are very hunter-centric. We have about 600,000 members, and they are very much hunters. And they even believe that our mission is hunting. And that has just not been the case. We are a conservation organization. And what you can see on this slide is, one is Ducks Unlimited, our magazine. The other is our new, brand new, hot off the press magazine, Wetlands America. And that is our new conservation magazine. So we are now beginning to reach out to the conservation community, folks that are more interested in ecosystem goods and services, those kinds of things. And like I said, I've been here 20 years trying to make this change. It's taken over 20 years to move our board from a position of not wanting to alienate our hunting base to reaching out to these other constituents. And so it's something I'm really proud of, but it takes a lot of time. When I was researching the background on water, I've done this for 20 years, and I still have to go back and remind myself of kind of how we got to where we are. I was really interested in the fact that, especially in this time, in this kind of this political climate that we have nationally, that, you know, reaching way back to Theodore Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot, who really developed the National Forest and National Forest Act, those kinds of things that back in those days, 1897, they were looking at how they could satisfy their urban constituents, right? A lot of their power and their constituencies came from urban centers. And part of that was making sure that they could provide ample clean water to those areas. And one of the ways was to protect the national forests and make sure that that water could reach those urban centers. If you think about our political climate today, most of the Democrats' power and constituents live in these urban centers. So it's really interesting to see how that has flipped. This came from a paper written by Justice Gregory Hobbs. If you don't know him, please look him up. This paper that I'm referencing is available online. Great history of the politics of water, the history of, of water. But he was Chief Justice in the Supreme Court of Colorado and very much focused on Colorado water law, an icon in water. And one of the other things that we have to remember when we're talking about water, and I'm sure you all have learned this, is that in Colorado, it is a private property right. Running water in its natural course is owned and it is the property of the public. But when that is diverted and put to a beneficial use, that water becomes a private property right, and it can be traded, it can be conveyed, it can be sold like any other property right or commodity. And that causes a lot of really interesting challenges for those of us in environmental and habitat conservation. One of the other things that we've really been focused on probably for the last 15 years is this idea that that water can be traded, right? And it can be sold. So way back in the day, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, agriculture filed on a lot of these water rights. I think it's something like 85% of the water is still owned and operated by agriculture. But that is moving to the municipalities at a very quick rate. What we see, an area that we focus on for the most part, is the South Platte Basin. And what we're seeing is that the rate at which that those rights are being transferred from agriculture to municipalities is pretty substantial, to the point where we think that by 2050, and we don't think this comes right from the Colorado Water Plan, is that by 2050, we will lose 180,000 to 267,000 acres of irrigated agriculture on the landscape. For us, that's important because that irrigated corn, all of the return flows that satisfy wetlands and provide habitat for wetlands and water for wetlands is provided by agriculture. So if we lose 22 to 32%, that could have exponential types of impacts on waterfowl habitat on the landscape. So we're very, very concerned about this. But the truth of the matter is that there are no laws that really protect wetlands in Colorado. There's the Clean Water Act that we work with quite a bit. But other than Swamp Buster, which doesn't really do a whole lot in Colorado, there's not a whole lot that protects them. And so we've had to find really innovative ways of working on waterfowl type projects in the state. And part of that is that we use irrigation rights to irrigate plants. So it's not really a wetland, it's really an irrigated field that just happens to be growing wetland plants. And we've been able to find a way to use the law to our advantage and accomplish those types of goals. And I'll give you an example of that project in a second. We also purchase water rights, and we change those water rights in Water Corp to wildlife, recreational, beneficial uses. Wetlands are not a beneficial use, so wildlife and recreation is one of the ways that we accomplish our mission here in Colorado. And then we use innovative water trades. Sorry about the background noise. And innovative partnerships, and that is really how we accomplish our goals. I forgot to mention earlier that internationally, we've conserved about 14 million acres of wetlands. We've done about 100,000 acres, about 110,000 acres in Colorado, most of that being on the South Platte River. So to give you an example of how we work with these water laws is irrigated wetlands. This is back in prior to the year 2000. This was basically just an irrigated farm that you're seeing here. And Ducks Unlimited worked with Colorado Parks and Wildlife, GOCO, Great Outdoors Colorado, and some others to actually purchase this land with the water rights that came with it. And we actually went in, built all these little lines that you see in here are all levees. So we built these levees, and then this long line that's running from south to north is the ditch. And so we divert water from the South Platte using the water rights that we purchased. And we irrigate these wetlands. And what that means is when we are in priority, when we can take our water right, we actually flood these wetlands, but we can only hold the water for 72 hours. And so we have to very carefully measure all of those wetlands or all of that water that comes in, measure it as it comes out. We make monthly reports to the state engineer's office as to how that's operating. And so you can imagine that this becomes a pretty intense operation pretty quickly, trying to work with Parks and Wildlife, with the state engineer's office, make sure that we're accomplishing all our goals and staying within the limits of the law when it comes to applying these water rights in this fashion. The other way that we've been successful is through what we call innovative partnerships. And a lot of this comes through Aquifer Recharge. I don't know if you've had a chance to talk about this much at all, but one of the ways that we are meeting the needs of Colorado's population is by taking water from the river when there's plentiful water. So all of these water rights were diverted during the summer and spring and summer months for irrigation. There's actually still a good portion of the year when there's nobody using the water in the river. So we actually take that water from the river in the winter months. We pump it and or divert it through a ditch, and we put it into a wetland that is actually modeled quite a ways from the river. And the water court actually accepts that this model works. And what happens is we put the water in this wetland. We get the waterfall habitat, as you can see. And then this water actually returns to the river unmanaged through the aquifer. So it goes into the aquifer, and it returns through the groundwater. And what you can see on this picture is this is the Platte River in 2002, which was the driest year in Colorado history. It is completely dry. And some of that is because of diversions from the river, taking whatever water might have been there and putting it to those beneficial uses. It dries up. Well, now we've developed a system that actually replenishes the river. This water is timed to come back. Put it in the wetlands in the winter. It is time to come back in the summer. And now we have what's called a gaining river. Instead of losing water, this river is gaining. So even when you have dry up points, the water will actually gain every mile. It gains more water, more water, more water. So the next person down actually has more water to use. We can actually divert. I think in 2010 and 2011, there was enough water diverted. I think it was between 300 and 500,000 acre feet of water. That's substantially larger than Glade Reservoir or any of these other reservoir projects you may hear about and are in the news pretty regularly, which are basically 170,000 acre feet of water. So we've built a system here that is mostly natural, that depends on kind of the natural attributes of the landscape to accomplish very similar goals, making sure there's more water for people. This is an example of one of the projects that we put together, and this is typically how we work. And this is a multi-partner project, and that's really important when we talk about the policies and the politics of water, is that when we put a project together, this in this instance, there was a individual that came to us had no water rights, had dry land ground on the South Platte. This is close to the Nebraska state line. And we said, yeah, there might be something we can do through this recharge program that I just explained. And so working with Lower South Platte Water Conservancy District and the state, we were able to file for new water rights in water court and built a 1.5-mile pipeline from the river to fill these wetlands. And we get the habitat. The Water Conservancy District gets the recharge credit, so that water that goes into the aquifer and comes back to the river, they're able to take that water that comes back to the river and use that to offset well depletions and all these other kinds of things. And then the landowner gets an appreciated land value in addition to improved recreational hunting, those kinds of things. So it's one of those situations where everybody that came to the table and worked out a scenario wins. So we're pretty proud of that. And that's basically, in a nutshell, how our program works for the most part. So the politics of wetland water is really interesting, right? And I hope that in the short period I've been able to impress on you, like, it is complicated stuff. It is not easy. It's not done by one person. It takes a lot of different connections to make this stuff work. And so when we work on these kinds of projects, it's getting the landowner to understand what the project is, agree, make sure that they feel like they're not losing something in the deal. They have water and irrigation districts that need the water, or they're willing to come to the table. But we had to overcome years of mistrust with them feeling like, well, we're just an environmental company that is not interested in making sure that they stay in agriculture, and nothing could be further from the truth, right? We are trying to put these projects on the ground to make sure that they can stay in agriculture. But there's all these misconceptions and mistrust out there. And I can tell you stories of farmers in particular, just screaming at me, I'm taking, 5 acres of their land out of production so that we can build a wetland. And the truth is that wetland is what's allowing them to keep irrigating because of the laws in Colorado. Grant makers and the state engineer's office is another one that that we work with constantly. The state engineer has to balance these different constituents. As an environmentalist, I just want to be able to put water on the ground and grow wetland plants and make ducks happy. But on the other side of it, he gets that same argument that we're taking land out of production, we're not using water beneficially, it's a waste of water. We hear a lot of those kinds of things. And so the state engineer will develop policies that a lot of times we've got to go in and fight. A more recent one was a project that I was working on, I think outside of Greeley. And the state engineer made the argument that if we dug down the ground level to take advantage of groundwater without exposing groundwater, that would be a change of use and we would have to go to water court and change it. And we had to work with them to say, well, wait a second, a farmer can change from corn to alfalfa to millet to whatever they want and never change that. They can change the landscape level. They can do all these things and never go to water court. Why are we any different? And so we have to work with the state engineer to help them understand that we understand what we're doing within the constraints of the law. And so the final thing too here is just, relationships matter. Whether it's working with the Colorado Water Conservation Board, the Colorado Trust, there's all kinds of reputation and relationships that we have in order to make these things work into these win-win scenarios. And if we're not accomplishing that goal, then it does mean to those things, those issues of mistrust, et cetera. And I want to finalize this with, money matters. Some of those projects that I showed you is that, the fact that this water is a private property right is driving some of those property costs up past $25,000 an acre currently, close to Greeley in the Fort Collins area, et cetera. And we're getting to a point where even developers are saying, I don't know if I can afford to build more houses when it's getting to be this kind of a cost. And so how can, as a conservation group, how can we actually accomplish some of these same goals when we can't afford something like $25,000 per acre? And so we're, you know, it's worth thinking about, you know, what's the role, you know, kind of one of the things that I challenge myself with all the time is, you know, what's the role of the difference between it's a public asset, but it's a private property, right? And it's driving that market is driving these costs beyond where we can afford to, you know, quote unquote, save the environment. And without the right regulations and those kinds of things in place, will we ever really be successful in what we're trying to accomplish? And that's all I had for today. I'll leave you with that kind of that question. And I am happy to take all the questions that you have. Thanks, guys.
Okay. And Greg, let me ask, are you going to have to run to a plane, or are you going to be able
to? Nope, I've got lots of time.
Okay.
I'll put myself on mute, though.
So I do have a question for you, but I want to hear Ian's first. Because the same question applies to both of them. But let me ask the students, do any of you have questions for Greg? Go ahead, Johanna.
Okay. So I was really interested in kind of if you guys have done research into the effects of the ecosystems through the river augmentation, because obviously you're kind of artificially transporting and changing where water is allocated and when. I was interested in kind of if you've looked at that impact on like the fish habitat and things like that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So this, using the South Platte only as an example, is that the ecosystem has really grown up around irrigated agriculture. So there was a period of time prior to settlement and kind of this gross irrigation across the landscape that the snowmelt would come through, it would flush the system out, and then it would dry up. And now you have a perennial stream that the ecosystem really depends on to make sure that all these different species can survive, plant species and animal species. And so it's a question that we all struggle with all the time, because there's a group that would say, okay, if prior to settlement, this thing just flushed once a year, what would it mean if we took that flush, that spring freshet and diverted it into reservoirs, or we lined it and we pumped a pipe and we just circumvented all that stuff that was in the lower river and just made it work like that? And by the way, it works great for us because we can store all that water and we don't have to worry. Well, the Endangered Species Act was also developed in the 1970s. And around all of these species that are built off of this irrigated ecosystem. And so if we start to move in a direction that diminishes the system that we currently have, you will really start to see those kinds of things, endangered species problems, those kinds of things really pop up. And so we think, at least, you know, the scenario that we use is one that still provides all the benefit to the ecosystem that we're currently dealing with versus an ecosystem that may have once been.
Okay, thanks, Greg. We're gonna, go ahead, Natalie.
I have a question also about the river augmentation. Has there ever been a time that you weren't able to divert because flows weren't high enough? And do you foresee that becoming an issue in the future where there might not be enough water for you to be able to divert?
Yeah, regularly. It is a natural system. It's a really hard thing to say, given the situation that we're in. We do know historically that the climate is up and down. We know there's dry years. We know, there's extremes. So far we haven't had to worry too much about that. There are definitely years, like 2002 is a great example, where 2001 was actually the dry year. And so we emptied all the reservoirs, and then we didn't get any snow and we couldn't refill the reservoirs. And so we couldn't divert for recharge. We couldn't do all these things. Like that's really the extreme example that we have to guard against, which is also the argument for making sure that we do have reservoirs out there, right? There's no one fix for what we're trying to address. And so reservoirs are part of the answer. What we're doing is part of the answer. But if we don't work together to come up with these different solutions, then, you know, we will end up with something where we've got people trying to build houses for all the folks that are showing up and we don't have enough water, right? And is that good? Is that bad? Depends on who you are, I guess. But that is definitely something that we struggle with. And the Colorado Water Plan and the folks that work on that are addressing that every day. It's a huge challenge.
Greg, thank you so much. Hang on, we might have questions later unless you have to take off. Ian Stafford with American Whitewater. Ian, you told me as we were chatting before that you've come from North Carolina. Tell us a little bit about how you got here and what your job entails.
Yeah, I will do that. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen to get this presentation on the road for everybody. Can everybody see that?
Yes.
Cool. All right. So, hey, everybody. Thanks for having me. My name is Ian Stafford. I'm with American Whitewater, and I'm going to be talking about water policy, recreation, and a whole lot of stuff that's in between it, because there is quite a bit that is in between everything that we do, and we work in a lot of similar places as Ducks Unlimited. We also work in a lot of similar places as economic development and working with water managers and things like that. So we're kind of across the board when it comes to recreation and how recreation is viewed throughout the state. And so, there we go. So like I said, my name is Ian. I'm born and raised in North Carolina, was born in Charlotte, North Carolina, and then went to school in UNC Greensboro, where I studied recreation management. After I graduated from UNC Greensboro, I moved straight out to Colorado and had found a summer camp out here that I got interested in and was really involved in outdoor education. And that's where I started really getting my foot into both the enviro world as well as the policy world. By working in the summer camp world, I worked my way up and I became a director, and I started running all of our wilderness logistics, and which we ran a lot of trips that climbed 14ers and went to a lot of different wilderness areas for backpacking trips and things of the sort. And so through that, I started getting involved in access issues and how do we get people outside? How do we get people onto public lands? How do we utilize these public lands in a way that is taking care of the land for future generations, but also being able to carry the load of the not just the recreation group, but also the agriculture that goes on that land, the conservation work that needs to be done, making sure that the wildlife and the ecosystem and the habitats are all being prepared and managed properly for current and future use. And so through that, started working with groups like with different land managers like the BLM and the U.S. Forest Service, and being able to work within small stakeholder groups, small community groups, and understanding so much of this comes down to the community level and being able to work with people and talk with people and find that common area where we're able to stand together. And so even through my undergrad, I really just discovered my life goal was just being able to get as many people outdoors as possible. Like, I don't care if you're sitting under a tree reading a book or trying to climb every single 14er in the wintertime. Like, whatever you want to do to get outside, go get your kicks. But I think people, there's just a really great thing that happens to people, to the human brain, to everything about it, when we're getting to spend that time outdoors. And so that's really been my motivation throughout life. Then because I work for American Whitewater, I feel like I just got to throw out there, I have rafted the Grand Canyon. I've done Deso Gray Canyon in Utah, as well as Yampa Canyon here in Colorado and into Utah. So I promise I do know what I'm talking about. Got to be able to, just in case there's any other whitewater folks out there and want to question my resume. I worked for American Whitewater after I got my master's degree at CU Boulder. Sorry, everybody. But from CU Boulder, I got my degree in environmental policy, and my sole focus in getting my master's was to really look at how can the outdoor industry take a larger role in policy development, either through the private side or through being able to unify that voice. In the state of Colorado, 91% of Coloradans identify as partaking in outdoor recreation at least once per year. And so that's a whole lot of people that utilize outdoor recreation in one way or another. Outdoor recreation is an incredibly broad topic that can involve some, in the state of Oregon, outdoor recreation involves utilizing walking on sidewalks. And so here in Colorado, we don't classify walking as sidewalks as outdoor recreation, but when you go out on a trail, when you go out to even going to like Red Rocks or something like that and walking around the trails there, that qualifies. And so there's a lot of people in this state that really utilize the public lands, the public access that we have to being able to get into the outdoors. And so with American Whitewater, we were founded in 1954. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization that really focuses on getting people outdoors, getting people to Whitewater River, whitewater recreation resources in a safe way, and by being able to protect and restore America's whitewater resources and being able to ensure that people can get out and enjoy them safely. I like to say that the way that we approach things is we want to make sure that anyone who, from people who are just wanting to have a picnic by a really cool whitewater area to people who are boating class 5 water, which is like the hardest of the hard, that all of those people in between there are able to access that whitewater resource to be able to enjoy it and see its beauty. We work a lot with a lot of different angling groups. We work with a lot of different recreation groups of folks who are, how trails are managed besides rivers and things like that. So we're a pretty small operation. We have 13 staff across the country, and that's broken into 6 different regions in the Southeast, Northeast, Northern Rockies, Southern Rockies, California, and Pacific Northwest. There's not a whole lot of whitewater recreation going on in the Midwest, but the few places that do, we also help out in those areas as well. So what we do is we really work, we do legislative work at the federal and state level, and then also work with local and county governments. At the national level, we're really working on wild and scenic river designation. And so that's taking rivers that have been classified through their land management agencies as having outstanding, remarkable values. That's the categorization that they have to meet. They have to meet a certain amount of these ORVs, as we call them, to be able to be classified as a wild and scenic river. We're working on hydropower relicensing operations. So dams have to relicense every 40 to 50 years. And so what we're doing now is by being able to approach these dam relicensing agreements, we're able to build in recreation protections. And so for instance, we don't have a lot of these operations here in Colorado, but like in West Virginia, they have a lot of hydro storage. And so they build in that these releases have to take place every Thursday through Sunday for 6 weeks. And so by building that in, we're building in these recreational opportunities that will last for 40 to 50 years. We develop metrics that are able to highlight recreation and identify metrics that can highlight recreation. So we help in survey gathering. We help in being able to understand what the flow preference of certain rivers across the country are, for what do boaters prefer at every single level. So going from class 1, which is very flat water, like your typical canoe, like what do people want? What are the kind of flows that people need to be able to do that on a daily basis, on a proper recreation basis, all the way up to at class 5, how does this river rate? If it's too high, it's too scary. If it's too low, you're hitting every single rock and that's not fun. So looking at it from that type of way. We do a lot of coalition development. When you have 13 people on your staff, if you don't work on a coalition, you're just going to drown. And so we have to make sure that we are able to really work with a lot of different groups, make sure that we're able to bring in more people to the table. We're always talking about expanding the table, expanding the conversation. That's a big piece of what we work around. And then last but most importantly, we want to make sure people can get out and play. If we're not playing, we're not doing our jobs right. So wild and scenic rivers across the state, here in Colorado, I'm going to talk about ours in just a little bit, but they can be designated in these 3 different categories: wild, scenic, or recreational. They can meet more than one, but they do need to meet at least one criteria to be designated as a wild and scenic river. They must be designated by Congress. This essentially is the most protection that you can bring to a river. Think of it as like you're turning this river corridor into a wilderness area. And so you're really protecting it from any upstream
development so that it can't take away from those ORVs that have been classified. And then it has the ability to come with a federal water right to protect the river flows. And that's a really big roadblock, especially here in the West and here in Colorado, for when it comes to these different types of river management operations. There are over 14,000 miles of wild and scenic rivers across the country in 41 different states. Here in Colorado, we have 105,000 river stream miles, but we have 76 miles are wild and scenic river, fun fact. So here's just a few really pretty pictures of wild and scenic rivers, because I think really pretty pictures in the middle of a PowerPoint presentation on Zoom is a fantastic thing. So these are wild and scenic rivers all over the country. Down in the left-hand corner, you're looking at, this is Yampa Canyon, which is not a wild and scenic river, but does have areas that meet the necessary designations. But then you have some areas up in the top left and the top right that are in Montana and Idaho. And then down the lower right, that's the Nolichucky River that's on the border of North Carolina and Tennessee, which is going through the process right now of getting designated. So what do I do in my role? I am the first ever Colorado policy strategist for American Whitewater. So I'm responsible for building out our policy shop and really growing the ability to be able to talk about the issues that we work on and where we want to, and helping direct where we want to go with our work, which is definitely daunting, but it's really fun and can be overwhelming at times, but that's okay. We're all overwhelmed. I help leverage AW member voices. We have over 6,200 dues-paying members across the country. Here in Colorado, we are our second largest state for members. We have over 640, and so that's a really great statistic for us, because it shows and highlights that Colorado residents really do value their whitewater recreation opportunities. And so these people pay annual dues. All of their dues go directly to projects. Nothing goes to overhead or anything like that. So that's a really big piece, is your dollars are going to work. So I leverage AW members' voices with their elected officials. I've traveled around the state and met with American Whitewater members and helped really try and break down that stigma of how do you talk to an elected official. It can be really daunting for people once you get really above the city and county level to talk to state and federal officials. Can be like kind of like, ooh, awestruck, or like you don't know what to talk to them about, when in actuality, like, they're all just humans, and we just need to like find those different areas where we really meet each other where we're at, and just find that area that is very similar for ourselves. Then working with coalitions to expand recreational representation. I sit on the advisory council for the state of Colorado's Outdoor Recreation Industry Office, which is a fantastic area that brings together every single type of recreationist to the table to talk about how can we grow the state's outdoor recreation industry office, or how can we grow the state's outdoor recreation industry economy in a sustainable way that really is taking into account all the different users, and being able to build that out in a way that's going to enhance that in the future and not take away from those resources. So right now, really, my focus is working in developing the next steps of our policy work. There's this little election that you may have heard of that's going on. And so we are working right now to identify who are we going to be trying to work with, what policy areas do we want to target here in the state, who is going to be running things that we need to be aware of, or what might we want to introduce or work with a coalition to introduce. And so pieces like that. And then help ensure that recreation environmental funding for the Colorado Water Plan, much as Greg talked about, that is a very foundational piece, or quickly becoming a foundational piece to how Colorado is managing its water, is looking at the Colorado Water Plan. Does this meet the criteria for the Colorado Water Plan? And being able to help ensure that the recreation bucket, which is one of the six buckets, it's recreation and environmental go together, making sure that we're getting adequate funding, that we're getting matching funding, and that we're being taken into account just as much as every other bucket that's taking place. And then recreation, economic development, I kind of got too excited when I was talking about the OREC office. Those two go together, obviously. Here in Colorado, we work on wild and scenic rivers as well, but we have to work on those in a different, in a little bit of an altered way. The Cashalapuda River, right here in Fort Collins, is our state's only wild and scenic river. It is 76 miles. If you drive up the canyon, as soon as you really start getting into the canyon, when the walls start coming up, you're in the wild and scenic area of the river. And so that is the state's only wild and scenic river. As I said, 107,000 miles of river here in the state. And so that's 0.1% of the state's rivers are protected as wild and scenic. Multiple rivers meet the necessary criteria through those ORVs, but there's really little conversation going around it because of that federal water right. People are really serious, as Greg said perfectly. Water is a big issue because it becomes a property thing. And when you're looking at private property and you're looking at property issues, like, people don't want somebody coming in being able to tell them what they can and can't do with their property, especially the federal government. And so what we have to do is we work on these collaborative ways. And so we've been working on the Upper Colorado River, which is the area that's like right by Kremling, going down through essentially from Grand Lake, where Grand Lake releases, and it goes through Kremling and into Gore Canyon, Pump House, that whole area, and then pops out at Dotsero there on I-70 after you've gone through Eagle. That's called the Upper Colorado River, and we've been working on a wild and scenic alternative plan there. And so what we understand is, like, okay, if you can't do this one thing, let's pivot. How can we still try and find ways to protect this resource for the future that are also going to be able to be lasting? And so it's not just something we're having to give up for future use. Tools to protect recreation flow is a big piece of what I look at. And the biggest piece that we do that is through recreational in-channel diversions, also known as RICIDs, R-I-C-Ds. And so recreational in-channel diversions are a way of diverting the water that is already in stream, is in the stream, and by being able to control it through a structure. A lot of times these structures are white water parks is the most common thing you see. If you've been down to the white water park here in Fort Collins, that is a brand new white water park for the very first RICID ever that was designated in 1989. But so these RICIDs are a great tool to be able to protect recreational flows, but they do require you to dry up the river to build these structures in them. And so it kind of has a give and take, because when you dry up a river, surprise, surprise, that's really bad for the ecosystem of that area. And so what we try and do is what kind of ways can we maybe work around that to protect these different types of flows? And so the Colorado Water Conservation Board has the In-Stream Flows Program, which just this past legislative session got strengthened by the development of the Loan Program and the Augmentation Program. And so these are ways that the Augmentation Program can provide water from stored water sources to be able to provide water to prevent dry up areas. And then the Loan Program is anyone who owns a water right, if they decide they don't need to use their whole water right that year, they can loan as much as they want to back to the river for to just stay in the river for environmental purposes. And so all of this really requires a lot of collaborative work, really requires being able to bring people to the table. Like I said, when it's a property issue, people are very hesitant. And so you have to really build up trust, build up rapport. It's a lot of being able to work together with people and help them understand, like, who we are, where we're coming from, and why we're trying to do what we're trying to do. The Colorado Water Plan, as I talked about before, it is a collaborative effort across the basin roundtables. There are nine basin roundtables throughout the whole state. And so we're working with any of them that have whitewater resources in them, we're working with them. A lot of times we're their go-to for recreation and purposes when it comes to on-river activities. We work very frequently with groups like Trout Unlimited, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, because it makes sense. A lot of anglers also have rafts because they like to be able to go boating while they're fishing. And that's also just really super fun. But right now we have a funding gap in the state of $100 million annually that we're trying to fill. Part of that gap was supplemented last year by the passage of Proposition DD, which is doing the sports gambling, profits of that are going to fund the water plan. But since that's all new and we've been in COVID and sports were shut down for a long time, the month of June, ping pong was the number one betted sport in the state of Colorado. Fun fact for you. Those are the kinds of obstacles we've been working with. And so like, we're very happy to see sports coming back because we're going to start getting an accurate depiction of what sports betting is looking like, but you should still gamble safely, everybody. So just make sure you're doing that. But then these funding issues, we're approaching in 5-year windows. And so ensuring that every bucket is funded to the same degree over a 5-year span. And then that will carry on for 30 years is what the plan is estimating. And then economic development, it's a big piece of what we do. Really working with economic diversification, being able to go to these river communities, towns like Craig that have coal plants that are shutting down in the next 5 years. And how do we help them pivot? How do we help them have a just transition to where people are able to have jobs that are going to be able to make up for what the coal plant was able to provide? Recreation is not going to be able to like supplement that entire economy. We fully understand that. But if we can make up 20% of that, that's a really big deal for these smaller communities. And so we are trying to work with them to identify how can you increase access? How can you increase publicity? What kind of infrastructure do you need to be able to get more people up here for boating opportunities? In the state of Colorado, the outdoor economy at the state level is valued at $62.5 billion every year. And so that's all outdoor recreation. But I mean, that's a lot of money. And so we also provide about 550,000 plus jobs through all types, that goes from seasonal to full-time on an annual basis. So the outdoor industry in the state of Colorado is no joke. At the federal level, it's $778 billion, and that's guaranteed by the government. And that's also been re-guaranteed through the Trump administration, which just goes to further show how important outdoor recreation is across the country. President Obama was the president that signed into law to really examine this for the first time, and then it was reauthorized about a year and a half ago, and we got those numbers back at the start of 2020, which is really exciting to be able to see that and be able to talk about that. And like, those numbers are what we're able to approach politicians, be able to approach city leaders and funders and say like, hey, this has salience to it. This is something that you can really build upon, but we need to be able to continue to grow it. And so being able to look at those two things, the economic diversification plus what the outdoor economy is already at, is allowing us to start developing an economic impact analysis so we can go to these smaller communities and say, hey, let's look and see how many boaters you're getting in here, how many recreationists are you getting in here, and what is that going to equate to in terms of dollars that are coming into your community in both indirect or both direct spending. So that's people coming in, going to the grocery store for their rafting trip that they're going on, or indirect spending, which is them coming in, going on a rafting trip, then going to the restaurant and spending way too much money on burgers and beer. And then what does that server do with their tip money? Because that money's staying in the local economy, which is really important. And then building on that quality of life. When you have a strong quality of life, you're able to keep your residents in your town. You're able to build upon the positive effects that quality of life is bringing to your community, which a lot of times is going to draw other people to come to your community. And so it all plays on that. It's all like a big ball that we're just trying to get rolling. And so that's all I got for you. I know I just talked a whole lot. There's my email address. There's my Twitter if you want to contact me. But I just thank you so much for taking the time. And now go out there and play and protect your favorite river.
Ian, thank you so much. Let's look to the students first. Any questions of the students? Go ahead, Mattia.
So when you work with those dams on their hydropower, do you find that you have to majorly change a lot of dam operations, or is most of it just keep doing what you're doing?
So I do want to preface, that's at the federal level that those conversations have taken place. And so I'm not really working on those, but by knowing what my colleagues do, It really depends on the dam and what the dam is doing. A lot of times you got to think about it, like if they aren't relicensing except every 40 to 50 years, some of these dams that are being relicensed right now were last authorized in 1970. And so the outdoor industry has changed dramatically since then. And so a lot of times, like, they didn't have built into their mindset in the late 60s and 70s to even take into account the idea of, like, what whitewater boaters would want or how that affects the outfitter community, the commercial outfitting community. And so a lot of times it's being able to take those dollar amounts of saying, like, hey, this is how this could impact this community. If you're able to have these 7 weekends where we're guaranteed to have perfect conditions for that long, like that could sustain a commercial operation for an entire year, being able to have those types of regular trips planned. And so that brings dollars into the community, that brings, and like these people who really operate these dams, like they're all locals, they're all people who live in these places. And so a lot of times you just have to be able to tell the story and get the conversation started. And so it's a lot of relationship building. It's a lot of talking to these people 5 years before it's even relicensing time, so that you can start having those relationships. So that when they're like, oh, hey, we're starting relicensing, didn't you say something about that? It's like, yeah, we sure did.
So I want to jump in here. The several reservoirs in Colorado have arrangements with folks as to when they release and how much they release, mostly for the recreational interests. And so that's a good partnership. Anybody else with a question? Miles, go ahead.
So you kind of just answered my question, but is there any like sort of protection for recreation given how big it is in the community?
There's no like guaranteed protection. So much of it is being able to talk about it and being able to really continue to build out those relationships. And I like really just can't emphasize that enough. So much of what my job is just getting our name out there and getting our name in people's ears. So when recreation comes up with rivers, I want them to automatically be like, oh, we should talk to American Whitewater. Because none of this is guaranteed. And I have a feeling Greg would also agree, like you get nothing guaranteed when it comes to environmental stuff being protected just because people have it in the goodness of their heart. When there's development taking place or a way to be able to divert water for some other type of use that could impact an ecosystem or something, like money talks and you got to be able to really highlight your case in a strong way and build up that support. And that's why so much of what the conservation community does is like really try and get these community followings and get these community voices to come out. Because when you get the community coming out and being like acting strongly on it, then you're able to really highlight the value of it and that this community wants this to stay the same.
One of the things that both of you talked about was building relationships and building trust. And Greg, you specifically mentioned farmers that were ready to shoot you, even talk about it. How do you go about building that trust? Greg, go ahead and start. And Ian, I'm going to kick it over to you.
It's a long road. It really is. You know, when I have a lot of questions for Ian too about wild and scenic and how long it takes to accomplish some of these things, right? In-stream flows is another good example, but the, I started literally going to water conservation district meetings on a monthly basis and just listening to what they needed and trying to figure out, you know, is there space for me here? How can I accomplish their goals while getting what I need out of it? And that was a several year process until someone took a risk and said, okay, let's get together. Let's see if we can build one of these things. And then it started to build on itself and go from there and build into something where people said, oh yeah, just like Ian said, oh yeah, you want to build a recharge project? Call Ducks Unlimited. You know, they aren't just a hunting group. They have money. They know how to put projects together and you're going to get the product that you expect. And so, that is what builds on itself. And over time, you can bring that hopefully one day you can bring that to a point where you're going to the state legislature and saying, you know, we've done pretty good with this program. What if we actually codified that and turned it into something that provides a little more of a guarantee? But it is a long, long road to get to some of these places that we all want to be.
Yeah. Ian, how do you approach gaining trust?
I think it's one, understanding that this in this day and age, we're so, especially me being a millennium, like attuned to everything. I need like instant gratification on everything, and that is not going to happen in these situations. And so a big piece to give a different example is in Colorado, you have a lot of ranchers, and ranchers like for their cattle to be near a river so they can have a water source there. And so a lot of times in the state of Colorado, there's a lot of folks that will put up barbed wire fences across a river to be able to say, like, that's my property boundary. Don't get on my property. Where in the state of Colorado, you have the right to float. You can't get out, but you can float through someone's property. And so with that, it can cause a very dangerous situation if you're in a raft or a kayak and you're coming upon a barbed wire fence that is strung across the river, or a fence. We see a lot of like people take like aircraft cable and hang that with wooden pallets that hang just at the top of the river. And so they get pushed by the river. But like, if you're in a kayak, that's not going to provide enough force to push a wooden pallet, or that's really going to hurt. And so what we try and do is we try and approach these different private landowners and just say, like, hey, like, we definitely understand, like, we will always encourage our recreationists to follow property laws and not get out on your property. But like, this is causing a really dangerous habitat, or a really dangerous place for our boaters, and can be could cause someone to die on it. And so with like, sometimes we get a lot of folks who are like, they'll show us their gun, or they'll like give us a few four letter words and tell us to get off their property. And like, when that happens, you're like, okay. But then like, sometimes after talking with other folks in the community, like, we'll get someone to bite. And a lot of times it only takes like one person to say like, okay, I'll listen to what you have to say. And then like, if you can get that one person to really buy into it, then like, they can tell their buddies who are also in the community, like, hey, like, this is actually really good. And they'll take care of the cost, and you're still covered under all of your insurance, because you're not liable for anything with this taking place. And so by doing that, like, it's able to really help us out by taking hazards off of the river, but also by being able to like continue that community rapport and development.
Looking to the students, are there any other questions before I open it up? Johanna, go ahead.
So I was really I was really interested in kind of, it seems really interesting that you have this one motion of really protecting the river, but then on the other hand, you're using a lot of dams to support your recreational activities too. And in the U.S., there's kind of this movement towards decommissioning or taking apart dams. So what's the stance of that that your organization takes about kind of dam removal projects?
Yeah, that's a great question. But that's really built into our mission statement. And our mission statement is to protect and restore all of America's whitewater values. And so by being able to, we're always going to think a natural operating river ecosystem is going to work the best. And so we're always going to support a dam being removed, especially, I think the last count was like the U.S. has like 74,000 dams and structures that block a river or stream. And so a lot of those are really antiquated, and they don't really operate to where they should be anymore. And a lot are just abandoned and forgotten. And that creates also a public safety issue for communities that are down below. I mean, if a dam blows out, like, that could really destroy a community that is built along the side of a river. We're always going to be in favor of responsibly removing a dam. We are never going to say like, to just go out and let's just take it down ourselves. That would be idiotic. But we, if it is healthy for the river system, then we're going to always be in favor of it. And it almost always is, as data has shown. And then also if the community wants that, we're never just going to like lead into a charge of something that a community doesn't want. That's a huge piece. Our team in California and the Pacific Northwest is working on a number of pretty prominent dam removals right now. And with that, like all of it is because communities got in touch with AW and were saying like, hey, we want to remove this, but we need help. And so we jump into that. And like some of those up in Northern California, the Klamath dams are getting removed. And a big piece of that is the indigenous community that's up there. They haven't had their salmon spawning grounds operating in a way that is natural. And that entire group of people are built upon the idea of these salmon runs being able to operate in their natural ways. And so because of that, it's exciting to get to work with these people and get to see them get a piece of their cultural identity back.
Rhythm, did you have a question?
So I was wondering that like recently, like since we found out a lot of invasive species in like water, and most of those like what studies of those transported were recreational equipments, like does guys deal with it? Do you have any proposed plans against it, or like doing before entering, like people enter? So like do you have any like checks or plans against that? Like, because do we get a lot of cues for species?
And Rhythm, I'm really sorry. I think that you were breaking up quite a bit there, but I think it was about invasive. The question was about invasive species and what our plans are for those. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're always going to follow the science on that. And we are big proponents of if a local watershed is saying like, hey, you need to wash your boat, you need to dry your boat, and you need to be able to highlight to the local authorities that may be that your boat is free of these invasive species. Like, we're always going to support that because we would never want to help be a reason that invasive species continue to spread. You see that in a lot of like national parks, a lot of reservoirs will do things like that where you have to show the bottom of your boat to be able to just show that there's none of those little critters have grabbed on. And so we're definitely in favor of that. It's difficult though in like your local communities. I mean, there's nobody that's standing on Clear Creek Canyon just outside of Golden that's like going to look at the bottom of your boat. And so a big piece of it for us is education and getting that type of information out to our members and out to our affiliate clubs, which have their own member groups. But then we also work with a lot of the commercial companies and a lot of outfitters, but also manufacturers. And so by working with the likes of NRS and Cocotat, we're able to help get safety information that is both for personal use safety, like how your PFD works, how your equipment works, but also what's safe for the environment. What should you and what should you not be doing? And so we're very much in favor of being able to prevent the spread of any of those invasive species. I hope that answered your question. I'm sorry it was breaking up.
Okay, anyone else with questions?
I have a quick question.
Go ahead, Christina.
Sorry, I can't see anything. They're working on the house inside. It's really loud. So my name is Christina and I work with the CSU Agriculture Water Quality Program. And I had a quick question for Greg. Two quick questions, actually. First of all, I'm really impressed with the solution of the aquifer recharge that you all have come up with. That's pretty ingenious. I've seen a lot of water projects and I'm impressed. Especially that the Conservancy District gets a credit back when the water goes back into the river. My first question is that you mentioned that you can hold the water for 72 hours. And is that a law in Colorado, or was that specifically just for that project?
Yeah, so a few different things. We didn't come up with recharge. It was actually some professors at CSU who dreamt it up back in the 70s and started to put it, implement it. And we just took advantage of it in the 2000s. But it is, it's impressive when you can put that amount of water to work through, you know, natural infrastructure and through the aquifer and manage it appropriately. I think that's pretty cool. The 72-hour rule, it is literally just a rule. It basically comes from a rule that is applied to irrigators because when they used to just flood irrigate everything, now they sprinkler irrigate. And so they flood a pond with their water and then run that out to their sprinkler. And in theory, it's about a 72-hour time frame from when they fill that and put the water onto their crops. And so they've just applied the same rule to wetlands. There's some nuances to that. We can do a flow through. So if we can fill that pond and then measure it so that we can show that the amount of water coming in is the same as the water going out, then it's not as big a deal. But again, it just intensifies the amount of time and data and energy we've got to put into managing these things. So that's basically where the 72-hour rule came from, and that is not going to change anytime soon. The water quality thing that you brought up, we do work with folks at CSU, Eric Wardle in particular, I'm working right now on how do we apply these same kinds of ideas to water quality, you know, on a large scale, and trying to remove some of these streams from the 303D list. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunity out there. If we can get it to a scale that matters, I think we could really have something, you know, really quality water, Poudre River, some of these other tributaries being, you know, a showcase almost for other areas as well.
Okay. Thank you so much. You answered my second question with the first answer about water quality. And Eric is my supervisor, so that makes a lot of sense. You're already talking with him. So
yeah, tell him to expect a phone call.
Will do.
And I was just going to say we have the state engineer here, Kevin Ryan, next week.
Oh, great.
And I believe the 72-hour rule, and I could be wrong with this, came from being able to store water and not have a water problem for it as long as it was put to the beneficial use.
Okay. So
it's also used in some reservoir operation, but that's a interesting question. I hadn't thought about it, so.
Make sure you ask Kevin about wetlands next week.
Will do.
All right. Thank you. Anybody else? Well, with that, Greg and Ian, thank you so much for spending. We went over. I appreciate you hanging on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How much we appreciated this. Thank you so much. And to everybody else who joined us, thank you. Have a good evening.
Thanks, everybody. Greg, have a good flight.
Yeah, take care. Good to see you.
Wait until everybody.